Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. This is part two of our discussion of time, whether or not time is absolute or is it relative. So joining me back on air is Daniel Hedrick of the God Is Now Here Ministry, who was with me for part one, and we're going to now finish up this talk on time, which is just so fascinating.
Glad to be back. And of course, we all know what the most important time is.
Now. I love that. And the listening audience, they can go back to part one of this show and listen to what we talked about as far as the importance of now. In fact, we might even talk about that again later in the show, because we're going to talk about the theological implications of time being either absolute or relative. So I can't wait to get to that. To summarize what we talked about last time, we at Real Science Radio, we believe that time is absolute. We do not accept the part of general relativity that time is relative. We think Einstein was wrong on that. And quantum theory also argues that Einstein is wrong. You have a debate now in the secular world between the general relativists, if you can call them that, and quantum theory-itists, the adherents to quantum theory. So the evidence that they use for general relativity, as we talked about last time, is you have these really accurate atomic clocks, and you can put an atomic clock on a mountain and then compare it to an atomic clock at the base of the mountain, and the atomic clock on the mountain is going to run faster. So they say, that proves that time is relative. Well, no, that just proves that a clock runs faster on a mountain than it does at the base. We believe that gravity affects the clock and not time itself.
You know, I remember Bob always talking about some of his own, thought experiments and stuff. But the very first one that I ever heard from him was the notion of, imagine someone creating a clock from a seal bladder, and you fill it with water, and then, you know, you put a pinprick in it, and you realize that over a certain amount of time that a number of drops comes out, and you realize, okay, good, that's a perfectly good clock. And then you realize, let's say a couple of days later, that the water is dripping faster and faster, and you're like, oh my gosh, time is speeding up. Well, what was it? Oh, they just happened to put a rock on top of the bladder, so now there's more pressure.
Yeah, well, that's a great analogy. Yep. So just like radiometric clocks, there's certain assumptions they have to make for a clock to be accurate. If something overturns those assumptions, that clock could be off by millions of years, you know? Say something like a global catastrophe, that could reset radiometric clocks, but that's a whole nother topic. So yeah, Bob had this really cool thought experiment, and you can find it at rsr.org/time-is-absolute, time-is-absolute, and you can go through his thought experiment there, and we're going to I think we should go through that real quick. What do you think, Daniel?
I love it. I want to hear it.
Okay. So Bob starts off, two atomic clocks have been running on Earth for billions of years, one at the base of Cheyenne Mountain and the other at the summit. It's sitting inside a well-maintained Chinook cargo helicopter. The clock on the peak has been running faster by a few nanoseconds per year, but over the eons, it has advanced to 24 hours ahead of the clock far below, and its readout in year, month, day, hour, minute, second, and nanosecond is just now turning over to indicate exactly 24 hours ahead of the other clock on a Friday at exactly high noon. This illustrates Einstein's prediction that time would run relatively slower at a stronger gravitational field as exists at the bottom of the mountain. We can ignore gravitational anomalies in mountains. Thus, the clock at the mountaintop is now one day ahead of the clock below. The clocks were installed to sit in a virtual perfect longitudinal alignment so that as the Earth orbits the Sun, both clocks cross an imaginary vector from the Sun in unison. The operator of the clock below, who was hired because of his PhD in physics, has just begun reading today's paper. The operator can read today's paper because they both exist at the same time, of course. He is alive and wanting and able to read, and today's paper has been just printed and just delivered to his facility, and since they are both there, the operator and the paper at the same time, he can read that paper. What do you know?
Exactly. No difference in time.
Yeah.
The guy on the top and the guy on the bottom.
Yep. So Bob goes on, however, if he wanted to read tomorrow's paper, he could not do it immediately because tomorrow's paper is 24 hours behind him in time. Now that's important here. And Bob goes on, behind him is the correct direction. He is ahead of tomorrow's paper, like a NASCAR driver who finishes 24 seconds before another. Our operator is here now, a full 24 hours before tomorrow's paper hits the newsstands. Remember, after all, the river of time flows backward, not forward, from the future through the present into the past. Imagine something floating in that current like next Christmas, which for us is next month, which is in the future, drifting toward the present, but eventually will be remembered only in the fading prints and family photo albums. And then Bob goes, but I digress. Assuming that the newspaper's production schedule remains constant with past performance, the operator will have to wait for 24 hours to pass before he can actually come into contact with tomorrow's paper, or for that matter, with anything that is 24 hours into the future. Now, we'll go back to the clock on the peak. The operator has kept an eye on that clock from its installation until today. He's now near retirement age. And with a telescope, he's been able to watch the nanoseconds ticking more quickly than those of his clock. Of course, he realizes that with the limitation of the speed of light, he's seeing the summit hands move picoseconds after they actually do, and that does not confuse his understanding. Being an educated man, he believes that time has been flowing faster for the clock above, and that is why the summit clock is 24 hours ahead of him and his clock. So Bob goes on. Now, it seems to me, the operator is confused and that the physicist must actually be referring by some other effect when they say or imply that gravity actually affects time as compared to other frames of reference. The seventh site found by web search on the topic states, gravitational time dilation is the slowing down of the passage of time, seemingly implying that time flows at different rates for the two clocks. If that were literally true, then it seems the two clocks would exist in two different time frames, now separated by 24 hours, and the operator at the base shouldn't even be able to see the clock at the summit since it's 24 hours ahead of him in time. After all, Feynman and QED notwithstanding, this guy just can't see that far into the future. Okay, so Bob goes on. Now the plot thickens. The helicopter, which has been maintained all these years at great taxpayer expense, suddenly transported the summit clock to the base clock, and the two clocks were set next to each other so that they actually touched. And the contact between the two clocks happened exactly 10 minutes after noon Friday, according to the summit clock, rounded to the nearest whole second. So here's my question. This is Bob asking in this thought experiment. What time would the base clock show at the moment they made contact? So Calvinists, most physicists, and evolutionary cosmologists would all answer that at that moment of contact, the base clock would read Thursday at 12:10 p.m. Well, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And Bob says, for what I know of relativity, which he says not much, but that's Bob for you. He knew a lot about relativity. They all happen to be correct. Consider how this thought experiment refutes time dilation. Whenever physicists claim that general relativity proves that gravitational gradients affect time, they are wrong. They don't. Gravity does not affect time. It affects clocks. And that is not the same thing. If gravity affects only clocks and not actual time, then like tomorrow's paper, the summit clock would not be one day into the actual future as compared to the base clock. And if it were quickly transported down the mountain, where it began ticking off time at the same rate as the other clock, then the summit clock would continue to give readouts offset exactly 24 hours ahead of the base clock. The brief trip down the mountain had a relatively negligible impact on its timekeeping. However, if different gravitational gradients truly affected time and the summit clock were truly one day ahead in the time of the other, then the helicopter should not be able to bring them into contact after a mere 10-minute trip. Explanation point. The duration of the flight was measured at 10 minutes by both clocks, again, by both clocks, within less than a billionth of a second. And then Bob goes, having worked at McDonnell Douglas on the AH-64 Apache attack helicopter, I know a bit about these machines, enough to state authoritatively that helicopters are not time machines.
Oh, that's well, so I was going to say that because he's using the Chinook, that's the biggest problem. He should have used the Blackhawk because it's a lot faster.
I think you did some work with those, right? Or at least with the security behind
them. Mission planning. Yeah, oh, wow. I did the mission planning. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Quite some time ago. So I think that this is a really great thought experiment that leads you to realize that this notion of relativism just doesn't, it doesn't make sense, and it breaks our intuition. And I think this is a great transition.
So if the summit clock truly experienced time faster than the base clock, then once the helicopter brought the clock to the base of the mountain, at that point, then another 24 hours would have to pass by before the operator at the base could even see the summit clock sitting there. After returning from lunch, behold, the clock cometh. So the operator would have waited until Friday at 10 minutes after noon before he could see the clock suddenly appear on the ground next to his base clock. But that is not what happened, is it? What actually would have happened is, having packed a sack lunch that day, he saw the clock at the same moment that it was being delivered. The summit clock and the base clock had been ticking at different rates for billions of years. Yet both had traveled around the sun the exact same number of times. Both clocks saw the exact same number of sunrises and sunsets. However, the summit clock's readout suggested that it had seen one additional sunrise and sunset than had the base clock, which of course it had not. The summit clock and the base clock both revolve around the Earth's axis in the same solar day at the exact same longitude, so to interpret their readouts as measuring different length days is to be confused. Genesis says that God gave us the sun and other astronomic bodies for seasons and for days and years. It turns out that God gave mankind great timekeepers and less misleading ones than our atomic clocks as interpreted by theorists. The movements within our solar system give us a more correct understanding of the absolute nature of time than do the ticks of atomic clocks. So whatever cosmologists are actually trying to say when they speak of time dilation, here is the truth. Gravity does not affect time. Gravity affects clocks. Now, Bob goes on to cover a little bit more on this thought experiment, but that really gets to the gist of it. And again, you can go to rsar.org/time-is-absolute, or just go to the rsar.org and search for summit clock experiment. It's a really good thought experiment. And, you know, he kind of in jest has a way to test this. And he goes, here's my suggested experiment. Let's hike to the top of 14,110-foot Pikes Peak and enter the snack bar at the summit, grab the old round wall clock, the one that's been up there so long that when removed, it will leave a clean white circle on the wall. And then we'll ride the train down to the base of the mountain in Manitou Springs and rush to the old ticking clock a few miles to the clock tower at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. And when we get there, we will touch the two together and see if the space-time continuum ruptures or anything like that.
So, I love that. That's great.
You know, just Daniel, because it's thoughts in my head. Just reading his thing here about the 14,110-foot Pikes Peak. Just FYI, that number changed because, you know, you remember numbers in your head especially when you're younger. Because I used to hike up Pikes Peak. We did it like five times, and that number was definitely not 14,110 feet. It changed. So they even changed the altitude of Pikes Peak only by maybe 7 feet. But anyways, I digress.
Well, even Mile High, they changed the steps. They removed the step, right? Where they had on the Capitol of 5,280 feet, they had to change it. I remember reading that a while back. Huh. Yeah, they moved it by like two steps or something.
Probably gravity and time dilation did that, right?
That's exactly right.
So anyways, that's Bob's summit clock experiment. And I think it's a really good way to illustrate how time isn't relative. It's these clocks are ticking at different rates and gravity is affecting how these clocks behave. And if you look at how atomic clocks work, you can see how Why can't you just see how gravity can actually affect how these electrons are changing states and whatnot? And it would really solve the problem of quantum theory doesn't agree with general relativity, and clocks are simply affected by gravity and not time. What do you think, Daniel?
Well, I really like that. And I think that the conclusion, at least from my perspective, is obvious. And maybe just another example to help someone that maybe is newer in their faith. An example is that the Bible says that Earth was created on day one. But in Genesis, day four is when the sun, moon, and the stars were created. So there's this notion that, at least from a biblical perspective, that if Earth is the original, you know, creation, and then the sun, moon, and stars are created on day four, then that time gap causes a problem. And I remember specifically being brought this as a scientific problem to believing in the Bible, is what's called the starlight and time problem. And the reason why I'm mentioning it, I'll go a little bit deeper into it, but is if I accept the notion that secular scientists say that Earth came from the stars, and then the Bible says exactly the opposite, not that the stars came from Earth, but they came after, then there's already a conflict there. So if I'm going to allow the Bible to be my guide towards salvation, I think it's sort of dangerous. Now, I'm not trying to ignore the science. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that I probably did that the very first time I heard of the problem of starlight and time, meaning if we're only 10,000 years old or younger, and then I look out into the heavens and I see a star 1 billion light years away, well, how in the world am I able to see that? I mean, it's a billion light years away. So clearly I shouldn't be able to see any of that. Now, when you consider the various views of various, organizations on how they try to resolve that conflict, way back in the day, we had Russell Humphreys talk about white hole cosmology, which wasn't generally accepted. I think the one that we had talked about in the previous show is the possibility that since the speed of light was a lot faster in the past, that's an interesting observation.
Yeah.
And then another one that Bob frequently mentioned over and over, and, you know, again, if we want to call it a miracle or just the way in which God utilizes his creation, is this notion of stretching out the heavens.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's very biblical too, because there's quite a few references to the stretching of the heavens.
Yeah, there's 11 of those, in fact. And so what does that mean? And I believe also in the previous show that I did with you a couple of shows back, I talked very briefly about how you could demonstrate in a very short amount of time by just writing down the letter E for Earth, S for supernovas or any other object in the cosmological frame of reference. And, you know, let's say that took me 5 minutes to write on that piece of paper and describe what I just said. And then I use a piece of scissors. This would be my stretching of cutting a circle around that paper so that it becomes a spiral. And then I stretch it out. And let's say that took 5 minutes. Or whatever, however long it took. But the point is that the time has no relationship to the distance. And I think that's what's really important.
Yeah, great point.
Me trying to describe this, right? It doesn't matter if it's 20 minutes or 5 minutes or 1 minute, they have no relationship to each other. And so when God stretches out the heavens, and then of course, even most recently, with the particle wave duality being a triality, I think the triality nature of it is that it's possible for us to be able to see those stars no matter where we are. And, you know, you had already briefly spoken about that.
Yeah, that was such a fun topic. And back in August, there was a couple of really good shows on the duality, you know, of light really being a triality. You know, they always had the horizon problem, the evolutionists did, with the whole starlight and time, because the horizon problem is that you can't get a homogeneous universe at the temperature that it's at in the 20 billion or whatever billions of years they claim that the universe, the age for the universe. There's no way that light can travel far enough to account for that. And so it's their own horizon problem, which is far worse than ours. We've got better science on our side. And that's what I've loved doing this show through the years, you know, 15 years now. It's like shooting apples in a barrel. We have so much evidence on our side. It's enormous, that really helps us defend our faith. And we have solid answers for so many of these questions. So, you know, this whole, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
So, Fred, so you're actually stating exactly the point. So when I was an early Christian and I was very much into the science, I mean, I was already studying, you know, hominids and, you know, geological activity, the whole bit. And yet the Starlight in Time, I mean, if you want to say it, it scared me for a moment. Like, oh my gosh, yeah. I'm going to be found out, you know? And then I realized, I mean, obviously over years of doing all the science stuff, that there is an answer. Yeah. So I would ask, at least temporarily, to maybe allow the Word of God to be a standard. So if we say that God is the creator, master designer of the universe, and God created the heavens, moons, and the stars on day four, and that there really is no problem with it, and then the secular world says it's billions of years old, and we know there is a problem between those two, well, the secular scientist is never going to save my soul. So yeah. I can table some of the things that they say, even if they contradict or maybe, you know, a contraindicator of what I believe. But
yeah.
If we allow theology also to be derived a little bit from philosophy, then I think we end up with this notion of the free will and the predestination.
Yeah.
So in this example, I think that we both believe in free will. Like, I had the freedom to get up this morning and choose whether or not I was going to have coffee or not. And in fact, if God, you know, knew me really well, he knows I'd have coffee because I pretty much had coffee every single day. But maybe tomorrow I'd go, you know what, I have a slight headache or something, and I'm just going to drink water. Now, I don't even know that I'm going to do that. That might be a reaction. But do I have the freedom to have that water, or does God already know that I'm going to have coffee? And so, you know, we've heard this debate in a theological world of whether or not we do truly have freedom. And also, just because God knows the future, does that mean that we don't have the ability to be free?
Yeah. So that,
yeah. So what I was going to say to this is that, to me, in my opinion, that when you consider all of time and that God is outside of time and in seeing it as a parade field, which is the most common thing I ever heard of. In fact, my friend Dwayne De Silva, who helped me out with God is now here for almost every single year, every year. So Dwayne De Silva was actually sitting next to Dobson from Focus on the Family. And they began to have a small conversation about free will and predestination. And believe it or not, he supported the eternal now. And the concept of eternal now is that all time is present before God. Yeah. And the reason why I reject that completely, and I remember reading the verse, you think I would know it now, but remember reading the verse that said, do not crucify the Son of Man afresh or again.
Yeah, again and again, which would be the case if it now is eternal. So this is getting into the whole theological background to, you know, time either being absolute or relative. And so, yeah, this is going to be really good. And, you know, to some of your earlier points, Daniel, for me, kind of a backstop from the Bible is whenever I'm thinking about science presented from a secular point of view is when God said, you know, the wisdom of the world is foolishness to him. So I'm always leery of something that the secular world pushes. You know, like when Fauci, this Dr. Fauci, when Trump had him up on in the media, in those press conferences, when the liberals loved him, I was warning my friends, there's something wrong with this guy because the liberals love him. So I'm sorry that sometimes I use that kind of logic. So with the Bible, I use sometimes I'll fall on the backstop of, the wisdom of the world is foolishness to God. And so now it's good that we look at the whole theological implications of absolute time versus relative time. And I wanted to read some headlines for you before we talk about, you know, eternal now or whether or not God is inside of time. So here's some headlines from the secular scientists. It's official. Time doesn't exist. And this is from toward datascience.com in January 2020. Then in April 8, 2018, Why Now Doesn't Exist and Other Strange Facts About Time, and that's in New Scientist. And then there's Time Is Not Real. Physicists show everything happens at the same time. And, you know, Einstein wrote in 1955, weeks before his death, the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. So Einstein was pushing the eternal now also.
Right, which obviously left him away from God, too.
Oh, absolutely. I guess, yeah, unfortunately.
In my opinion, because he certainly was not a believer. Now, when we consider the word now, which obviously I'm a complete fan of. That's right. There's a couple of verses, and actually, let me ask you this. Do you know how many times the word now is recorded in the Bible?
I think it's in the thousands.
Thousands. So it's so interesting to me that the word now is being used over 1,000 times. And, you know, we've all heard it before that if God is interested in teaching you something or telling you something, he'll repeat himself. So, I mean, the repetition of a concept called now, if it doesn't mean what it says, what does it mean?
Yeah.
So one of the verses in my favorite one, do you remember who John Piper is?
He's probably one of the leading
Calvinists. So I wrote to him probably 15 years ago. And all I did is I wrote to him and I said, I would like you to exegete. I had learned those big phrases, eisegete and exegete. So I felt really proud of myself. And I said, hey, you know, hey, John, could you exegete 1 Samuel 13:13? And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever.
Hmm.
Now, when I heard that, just because I'm one of those reactionaries that tries to get someone to react, I would say, well, obviously God's lying there, or Samuel's lying, however you want to say it. And the reason why is because he already knew that King David would be king. God already knew that. So why would he say something as foolish as this? For now, the Lord would have established your kingdom upon Israel forever. No, he wouldn't have.
Yeah,
definitely not.
If there was an eternal now.
Right. So I think that you have to allow that verse to say what it means. And if it means what it says, then it's very similar to what Bob always used to say, something to the effect is, do you think God would have been perplexed if Judas would have repented? Like, uh-oh, my entire plan has failed now because, you know, one of my own repented.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh no, I can't do anything now. You know? So obviously I don't accept that. And I think God could have had everything happen the way he would, let's say, want or needed to communicate the fact that he was going to the Gentiles, you know, after Israel. But another verse, which is another one that I really like, and especially because I definitely lift up a Paulinist point of view, meaning just that Paul had a lot to say about everything and we should listen to him because he was the apostle to the Gentiles. And he says in Colossians 1:26, even the mystery which hath been hid from ages and from generations, but now is made manifest to his saints. So clearly there is a moment in time where something's revealed that was not revealed before. And the term now happens so many times, I guess I really don't even understand how someone who believes in this notion of relativity could make any sense of the phrase now.
Yeah, so how did Piper respond to your request? I'm curious.
Oh, right. I forgot to that. You know what he wrote me back? He did write me back. Very thankful. Yeah. Guess what he said? I don't have time to exegete such a verse. That's all he said.
I don't have time.
I'm like, yeah, that is funny, right? And I think it's, well, the reason where I brought it up is sort of what you said about when someone, I guess maybe is against your views or whatever, but a secular person or even a religious person and says something and you just know, wait, I just heard him say that he doesn't have time to exegete this passage. Wait, how long would that take?
Exactly.
Like, I mean, literally one minute or two.
Yeah.
So to me, that was a very early indicator that the idea of the open view or what I actually call is the partially open view, because I think there are things in the future that God has cemented, you know, like the new heaven and new earth and things mm-hmm. like that. That's cemented. That's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. But there are other things that are not cemented. And the example in this case is, even though that the bride of the Lord is going to be married in the future, the marriage supper of the Lamb with the bride, that doesn't mean that you are going to be in the body.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that future is guaranteed that there will be a marriage. It just means that maybe you won't be in it, right? So that would be the difference between saying something's predetermined, right? Something in the future that there'll be a party, but not who the participants would be, something like that.
Yeah. And I wanted to mention an article that I found on the internet when I was searching for Eternal Now. And there's this guy named Craig Fisher, who Dom Inyart just indicated to me earlier that he was actually good friends with Bob. I didn't realize that. But he wrote this, which I think is spot on, and it deals with this whole question of eternal now, which is what Einstein pushes and, you know, secular physicists. He wrote this: in the Calvinist universe, death is not swallowed up forever, but it lasts forever in the eternal now. The tears of pain last forever, and the Lord never wipes all the tears away. In order for God to see all things in the same way, observing past events like they are present and future events as they are in the present, these past and future things would have to exist. In Isaiah, God says he declares and then makes things happen that are not yet done. So, like, for example, is Isaiah 46, verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. If some things are not yet done, then the future does not exist in the eternal now, even for God. God always presents himself in Scripture, always, as being in temporal time. He never presents himself, as in the movie Back to the Future, as being able to return to past events and go forward to future events and then return to the present. The classical theologians, Calvin and Augustine, are all wrong. God does not exist in the eternal now. And what a great argument. And it gets back to your point, Daniel, that verse about don't crucify Jesus again, because if God's in the eternal now, he has to experience that for all eternity.
Yes. What I always used to say, Fred, is if the eternal now is true, as an example, then God could go back in time, rename Abraham to Fred Flintstone, right? So literally all of our Bibles will say Fred Flintstone now. And then, of course, God just put it back again.
Yeah.
Right? It's right back to Abraham. So you never even know,
never
that,
even know that there was
Fred
a change.
Flintstone.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, because I'm in the later version of now instead of the earlier version of now. So I guess what I would like to just kind of wrap it up, at least in my own thought with everybody in the audience, is that we've tried to talk about science, we've talked about philosophy, and we've talked about the word. And when you have a holistic approach, then you realize the most important time is now. And so when we go out into the world and we try to share the gospel, whether it's through science or any other number of approaches, now is the only time you have. That's it. You don't have any other time. You can't go into the past. You can't go into the future. So when's the most appropriate time to be doing something for the Lord?
Now.
How about right now?
Yeah. What a great point. And you know, when the production team for Real Science Radio was deciding on the next show, we decided on talking about absolute time. And it was really a coincidence that, hey, we had just had Daniel Hedrick on from God Is Now Here. Wouldn't it be great to have him help us do this show? Because it's so much, yeah, it's so much fits in with your ministry and what you've been talking about. It's so cool. So actually, Daniel, believe it or not, we are out of time. So, even though time keeps marching on. So anyways, I want to thank you very much, Daniel, for helping me and the audience get through this really kind of a complex topic, a little bit both theologically and scientifically. But it's so fascinating. It's really cool to talk about absolute time versus relative time. And we hope that the audience was able to at least get a good, strong feeling for the concept and why we believe the Bible, absolute time is the answer of what the Bible speaks of. It's what Isaac Newton, his classic physics, is absolute time. And it's biblical. Relative time is not biblical. That's what we believe at Real Science Radio. And like you said, there's over 1,000 verses of the word now in the Bible. We encourage everybody to just look into the issue. It really is fascinating and interesting. And you can support our show by going to rsar.org/store. There's tons of great material. And if you want to learn more about absolute time, you could start with getting Bob's signature work called The Plot of the Bible. You can get it in either paperback form, or if you want to read it on your computer or your iPad or whatever, you can download a copy of it for that device. So Daniel, thanks again for being with me to go through this really fascinating topic of time.
Absolutely.
That sounds good. So for Daniel Hedrick, this is Real Science Radio, and Fred Williams, may God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.